Thank you for the introduction, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference. I'll start off by calling the notion of a semi-abelian variety. So S is a semi-abelian variety over the complex numbers. So it's an extension of an algebraic torus, or of an abelian variety by an algebraic torus. So the Mordell-Lang conjecture governs the intersection of subvarieties of S with subgroups of finite rank. More recently, new conjectures have been formulated on which govern the intersection of subvarieties of S with the union of all algebraic subgroups with certain codimension restrictions. So I'll start off by defining what I mean by codimension restrictions. So for any integer r, I define S, upper brackets r, to be the union over the complex points over all algebraic subgroups of S with codimension at least r. So in general, this is just a subset of a set of complex points of our semi-abelian variety, and it doesn't have a group structure in general. Also, example if I insert MS, then I'm just taking the union of all zero-dimensional algebraic subgroups, so I just get the torsion points of S. And if I insert zero, I just get S itself, because S is an algebraic subgroup of itself. Now, the conjecture I was referring to before about intersection of subvarieties with this set here, well, there are several ways to state it, and one way was stated essentially independently by Boris Silber and Richard Pink. I'll call this conjecture A for the moment. Well, in the conjecture, we have a subvariety of S, which is irreducible, defined over C, and with a property that the subvariety itself is not contained in a proper algebraic subgroup of S. And the statement is that the intersection of S, A of X, with the union of all algebraic subgroups of codimension at least 1 plus the dimension of X is not dense, not Sarisky dense. In X. Okay, so what's the intuition here? If we intersect X with a fixed algebraic subgroup of codimension 1 plus dim X, we expect an empty set just by a dimensional argument. And so what we have here is essentially a union of infinitely many empty sets. Of course, there could be intersections which are non-trivial, but what the conjecture says is that we get something non-Sarisky dense if we take this big union. And so in a certain special cases, the conjecture is known. So if we look at what happens in low codimension, if X is a hypersurface, then conjecture just says something about the intersection of X with S, where we have dim S here in the brackets, and that was exactly the torsion points. And so what we're looking at here is exactly just the intersection of X with the torsion points of S, and this is controlled by Mann-Munford conjecture. And the property of the hypothesis here on X just says that X is not translated of an algebraic subgroup by a torsion point. So here, this is not dense. By Mann-Munford, if X isn't contained in an algebraic subgroup, which is proper. And, well, Mann-Munford is, of course, a well-known theorem, proved by Renault in the Abelian case, by Laurent and Andry in other cases, especially in particular in the semi-Abelian case. So essentially, the conjecture is equivalent to Mann-Munford if we're working with hypersurfaces. In fact, it's been well known, though, since 2005 that the conjecture not only implies Mumford in the general case, but it also implies Mordo-Lang in the general case. This was shown by Richard Pink in 2005 in a preprint that conjecture A implies Mordo-Lang, which is, of course, also a known theorem. Should say also that Boris Silber, his logician, and he was motivated by model theory, stating the conjecture, also related with Shanel's conjecture, and Richard Pink was motivated by a more general conjecture on Shimura varieties, which implies this conjecture and also the Underwood conjecture. So it's a common generalization. So we've seen that the conjecture at least holds for hypersurfaces, so in low codimension, very low codimension. A bit more is known if we work in codimension 2 and in for certain special S. So this is a result by Bombieri, Masser, and Sonnier in year 2007. Conjecture holds if S is algebraic torus and the codimension of X is 2. So it's like a hypersurface. And if everything is defined over field of algebraic numbers. So if your variety is defined over Q bar. And so that kind of completes everything that's known in a small codimension direction of this conjecture. Now this is the one that doesn't work, right? Okay, I'll just continue here. There's a pretty big gap now, which was known between low codimension and low dimension. But if we go to low dimension, we have certain results, namely mainly for curves. So if this is due to a recent result by Caritzosa in 2008, that if we have a curve, X is a curve, and A is a Abelian variety with complex multiplication. Then the conjecture A holds for X, and so also here X has to be defined over Q bar as well as A. And so the conjecture actually says is actually finite in this result in the case of curves because Sirisky, because Sirisky non-dense is just finite for curves. So this result here builds up on the work of Raymond and Viotta, who proved the same result a bit earlier for special cases for powers of elliptic curves with complex multiplication. So this is essentially the most general result, which is now known for curves in Abelian varieties. And, this is proved by Raymond, Viotta, in 2003. And, that more or less is the Abelian situation. In the toric situation, we also have results on curves, and this was proved by Morin in 2008. Here we have a curve, again over Q bar, and conjecture holds. So Morin's theorem just says that the set of points on this curve, X, assuming that it's not contained in a proper algebraic subgroup, the set of points which are contained in an algebraic subgroup of codimension at least 2, is finite. And here we also have the restriction that the curve has to be defined over Q bar, and this restriction was eliminated by Bombieri and Mastrosani in a preprint where they showed this result, the curves over the complex numbers. And they rely on this result and a sort of specialization result. So they show a way to go from results like this for varieties defined over field of algebraic numbers to varieties defined over field of complex numbers. So what I want to do in my talk is not concentrate on this conjecture directly, but concentrate on a conjecture involving height bounds, as I said in my talk. And so I have to introduce a certain notion of height. And, well, I'll just do it ad hocly. The algebraic torus, we can just take the absolute logarithmic Y height. Just denote it by H. S is an abelian variety. We'll take the Meyron-Tate height. Associated to some ample symmetric line bundle, LA. And if S is a semi-abelian variety in general, well, this case is not really going to show up in my talk, but just for sake of completeness, Sayre showed how to construct the height on this group variety. So you can, this is shown by Sayre how to do this. Well, S is quasi-projective, so you might as well just embed it in some projective space and take the height, the Y height on projective space and restrict it to S. That's essentially what happens. Well, we're also going to actually forget about this line bundle here most of the time, because actually what we want to show in the end is a height bound, and it doesn't really matter what line bundle is. We're using, because we're not concentrating on explicit or effective results, but just more or less qualitative results. So instead of trying to prove non-density or even finite results, like in this conjecture A, we're going to try to just concentrate on proving height bounds. And so this is what I'll state as conjecture B. And this was stated originally by also Bombieri and Mastrosani in 2007 for the algebraic torus. And it generalizes easily to semi-abelian varieties once one has a notion of height. So we're in the same situation, actually, as in the beginning of the conjecture A. We have a reducible subvariety, X. And the claim is twofold. First, there exists a certain natural Zariski open subset of X. I'll put natural in apostrophes. And there exists a real number B with any point lying in our open subset and also contains in any algebraic subgroup of codimension at least in X has that height bounded by D. So in other words, the height of points on the set here have uniformly bounded height. So I wrote natural here because the definition, you can actually give a definition of XOA here, which is more or less geometrically motivated. I'm not going to do that in my talk, but one thing I should remark at least is that once one has defined XOA, which is essentially by removing from X certain anomalous subvarieties, it's not obvious to see that what one has Is the risky open? That's another point. I'll get to that in a minute. So, openness, first remark, is not obvious. So once, if I would write down the definition, it would not be obvious from the definition that it's a risky open. The second point, well, I'll just write down who proved it. Well, this is actually proved by Bombieri, Mosse, Sonia in the same article which they stated this conjecture. It proved openness. If S is the algebraic torus, and Guy Ramon proved it. This is as of yet, well, it hasn't appeared yet, but it's a preprint, proved it. Openness. In the case of Abelian varieties. Okay, and yeah. But it's not, it can happen that XOA is empty. Well, this is possible. I mean, if you XOA, for example, is itself an algebraic subgroup with certain additional properties, it's not hard to see that you can never have a height bound here, suitable height bound on this intersection. So, because I didn't give a definition of XOA, I'll at least tell you when it's empty and when it's not empty. So, this follows also from the results here. XOA is not empty if and only if following holds. For all projective morphisms of Abelian varieties, we have that the dimension of the image of X under phi equals the minimum of the dimension of X and the dimension of B. So I'm just stating this here for Abelian varieties. The same also holds for the algebraic torus, and well, it's not known in the semi-Abelian case because essentially no one has done this yet in the semi-Abelian case. So. Similar thing holds for algebraic torus, and well, you see, it's not hard to see that this dimension here is, of course, always at most this right-hand side here, and what non-emptiness is essentially equivalent to saying that we always have equality here. And so as an example, what if we're in the situation of conjecture A, where you have a subvariety, but which is contained in an algebraic subgroup, which is proper. Then we look at the projection from A.
I understand your empty. Is it always true when it is empty?
When this is, there's a non-trivial direction in this statement. And,
I mean, the conjecture yourself, it could be empty.
Yeah, it could be empty. Then the conjecture is true.
The conjecture is true.
When it's empty, yeah, because then it's vacuous. But if it's not empty, then you have to prove something.
There are no points in X or A.
Yes, the conjecture. So what is the point of conjecture?
Well, the point
is already true for empty state, why you made conjecture?
Well, the openness is known. There's a risky openness of X or A is known. And if it's non-empty, then the conjecture is not vacuous because we have to prove.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to define it at all, actually. I'm just going to use this property here on non-emptiness. That's actually the only case where the conjecture is interesting.
But what I gather from what you're saying is that you can actually write down a description. This conjecture actually for a particular open set.
Yeah, you can really write down what this open set, what the set looks like, and then you have to prove that it's open. It's like removing it's like removing bad subvarieties of X. So in this case, if we're in the case of the conjecture, but where X is now really contained in an algebraic subgroup, which is proper, and we look at the projection of A onto the quotient, A mod H, then, of course, X reduces to zero, and this inequality is not satisfied if the dimension is positive. So if the dimension of X is greater than zero, then X array is empty. So the hypothesis here is actually, even though there's no hypothesis at all on X, it's stronger here than in the conjecture because this X array could be empty. But the trade-off is that we're being able to work with a larger union here of algebraic subgroups. See that the algebraic subgroups here are only assumed to have codimension, at least in X, whereas in the conjecture they have to have, well, they're smaller, the dimension is smaller, in general.
So this is
just subjective. So actually I'd have to write for all B and all surjective morphisms from A to B, but the image doesn't like get too small. So this is also a remark here. This is in general a bigger set than the one in conjecture A, but the trade-off is that the hypothesis on X is stronger. So, also, there's been progress in direction of the conjecture B. I'll write that down. It's also start in a large dimension or small codimension, and well, if X GM to the N, now everything is defined over Q. There's a hypersurface. So actually we're just taking the intersection of a hypersurface with the union of all algebraic subgroups of dimension 1, then conjecture B holds by result of Pompieri and Tanier from 1995. And then we also have to go down to low dimension to get more results. So we have to concern subvaries of the algebraic torus. If we have a plane, a two-dimensional variety defined by linear equations, then conjecture B holds by a result of also Bombieri, Masters, Garnier, which is, as of yet, I think, unpublished. And then going further, all the way down to curves, this was essentially one of the original papers on the subject. This was also proved by Bombieri Masters in 1999. And on the abelian side, there's a result by Raymond, which covers curves in abelian, in any abelian variety. And this is by Raymond in 2005. And so I guess the result I want to present today is a theorem which says that conjecture B holds for S equals either the algebraic torus or an abelian variety. And any X. Of course, the openness part is settled already by these two groups of authors. And so what I'm interested here mainly is getting the upper bound for the height on this set here. And well, it's been known actually since quite a long time that getting upper bounds for the height like this is a certain, gives a certain method of attack of this conjecture A here. And this also leads to corollary of the theorem. And the first corollary would say that if X is a subvariety of S with S equals GMN, or S equals an abelian variety with complex multiplication, and we also have this now, this assumption that XOA is not empty. So exactly this property here holds for X, then conjecture A holds for X. So, I mean, what can we say on the intersection of X with the union of all algebraic subgroups of dimension at least 1 system X? Well, if I write XOA here and dimension X, then I have bounded height. So at least on a Zariski dense open subset of X intersected with this guy here, I have bounded height. And going from bounded height to finiteness involves using certain Lehmer-type height lower bounds. So the proof of the corollary uses a theorem and Lehmer-type height lower bounds. Essentially due to Amoruso and David in the toric case and to Carrizosa in the abelian case with complex multiplication. And it's exactly this why we need this theorem hypothesis. If we'd have a suitable height lower bounds for any abelian variety, then we could get this corollary also for any abelian variety. So actually the whole thing depends on this height lower bounds. And deducing the corollary from the theorem is rather standard if we have such lower bounds. And I should also say that... I'm coming to that in a second. Yeah. This doesn't imply Mordell Lang yet. Okay, so I should also say here that a recent approach due to Viada and myself made it possible to apply Bolkomolov-type height lower bounds in order to get finiteness results in this direction. And so I'm coming to your comment, and using different methods, Guy Raymond has obtained a stronger version of the corollary involving also a subgroup of finite rank. So what he has here is essentially also a subgroup of finite rank, so that immediately implies Mordell Lang. The methods here are slightly different than in the theorem here. And so actually this is also a point if we would try to deduce Mordell Lang from this theorem alone, it's not possible just because of this XOA, because in the essentially interesting cases this XOA would be empty. And we'll see all later on that this theorem can probably or maybe be able to be made effective, and so there's no hope of getting a Mordell Lang directly out of this theorem, because that would give effective Mordell Lang, and that's of course out of the question. But what one can do is, I'll write this down as a second corollary, is oh, sure, yeah. I'll write down just in a second corollary that if So if we apply the theorem to surfaces, then this conjecture A, or this conjecture stated by Zwibor-Pink, holds for curves in GM to the power n, for curves in the algebraic torus. And this was originally proved by Morin on the blackboard above, but the approach of the theorem gives a second new proof of this result for curves in GM to n. It probably also gives a result for abelian varieties. I haven't just checked this yet, though. But one aspect of this new proof is that an effective version of the theorem implies an effective version of Morin's theorem. So it would imply an effective version of Morin-Lang, but we're working in the algebraic torus, and for curves, this is already known. So there's nothing really new in direction of effective Morin-Lang here. And of course, an effective version of theorem, even if it applies conjecture A for curves in the Mendelian variety, won't imply an effective version of this conjecture A in the Mendelian variety. Just a side remark. So I guess that kind of ends the overview of the introduction. So in the second part, I want to discuss a bit the proof of the theorem. I'll sketch it. And well, I'm going to concentrate on the abelian case. So we have a subvariety of an abelian variety, A. And we're also going to assume, of course, that XOA is not empty. Or else the statement is trivial. And well, actually, not. Okay, I can write it down because I guess I'll save time that way. So what we do is we consider subvarieties of X which have positive dimension, at least curves, and which are contained in the translate of an algebraic subgroup. This is algebraic. And such that the dimension of Y, so it's contained, Y is contained in the intersection of this translate with our X. And we're considering only those such that their dimension is greater or equal to the dimension of X plus the dimension of H minus the dimension of the ambient group variety plus 1. So we're considering more or less the reducible components of this intersection which have dimension which is too large. And to get X away, we take X and remove such Y. Okay, so we're removing certain varieties contained in X which intersect translates of algebraic subgroups in a anomalous way. And see, from this characterization, it's not obvious that it's open, because this union here may be infinite, and so you can't really see that it's a risky close. But actually, what I'm going to just work with this characterization of non-emptiness, so X O A can be forgotten after now. We're just going to use that, the fact that projections here do not reduce the dimension of the variety. So, sketch of the proof, we assume that XOA is not empty. And what happens if we have a point P in an algebraic subgroup H of codimension at least dim X? Well, what can we do with this point? How can we get information out of the H? We first have a projection of A on for the quotient, A mod H. And inserting P, this morphism, of course, we get 0. So, in fact, what we're looking at is we're looking at the varying kernels of morphisms like this intersected with our variety X. Okay. Of course, the P is allowed to vary because the subgroup varies. Okay, so a forced reduction step, because an abelian variety up to isogeny is only finitely many quotients, we can take this A mod H as fixed. This is a follow from the theorem of Poincaré, or Poincaré's complete reducibility theorem. We can fix A mod H to be some abelian variety B, which will just be fixed throughout the rest of the talk. And just to use an isogeny between these two guys, and of course, P will also be contained in the respective kernel. And of course, this guy here, B, the dimension of B is exactly the codimension of H, and so the dimension of B is always at least the dimension of X. So we're not looking at really varying quotients, we're just looking at varying morphisms between two fixed abelian varieties. Okay, that's the first reduction. And the second reduction is we don't want to look at all morphisms, but just certain from a certain class in order to simplify things. And to do that, we note that we have a left action. Of the endomorphism of B on Hom AB, which is by posing. We can also tensor everything with R and take the units. So the left action of this group here on this finite dimensional vector space. And this is a semi-simple ring here. So it's essentially just a product of matrix rings over skew fields. So essentially we can just do linear algebra to study this action here on this set. Of course, if you have a field like over there, and where P is contained in the kernel, and we left multiply it by an endomorphism of B, it's still contained in the kernel. So this action here essentially just is a kernel invariant. So we're allowed to apply this action to our phi. And the second reduction step essentially says that there's a compact fundamental domain of this action. So there's this K subset Hom AB tends to R compact. There's two properties, namely that first, any element in K is has a right inverse, or is surjective. Has a right inverse in Hom BA comes to R, so it's just more or less means that any element of K is surjective. And the second property says, well, it just restricts us the set of morphisms we're looking at here, is that for any, if P is contained in the kernel of a surjective map between A and B, then there exists a homomorphism where P already vanishes, such that P divided by its norm is contained in K. So, well, here, norm is any norm on this finite dimensional vector space, coming, for example, from a polarization. So this more or less says that we can restrict to certain phis such that a multiple of this phi is contained in the compact set. And we're interested in, and of course, this set here. Sort of P and X, such that there exists phi with phi of P equals 0 and phi over the norm of phi in K. This is a set where we want to bound the height on, because this essentially is the intersection of X with the union of all algebraic subgroups with this codimensional restriction. Okay. I'm already forgetting about this XOA here because for simplicity reasons. So that concludes more or less the reduction step.
And you're fixing the compact set K.
This exists, yeah, and it's fixed for now.
So my question is, Dan, that you're going to do with this, are you going to work with the K that you found in reduction step?
Exactly.
Or are you just going to pick some compact set?
We're going to work with this K.
With that?
Yeah. Okay. So this is essentially just that the Grassmannians are compact in a certain different language. So in the second part, we work with height inequalities. We haven't spoken about heights yet. So if we have a map like this here between A and B, which is surjective, and now we can use this property I just erased, fortunately. But what it said essentially in our situation is that the dimension of the image of X in our case here is equal to the dimension of X. So projecting down with our phi doesn't really lose any dimensions. And so what we have, if we restrict phi to X, we get a morphism between two varieties of the same dimension, which is dominant, and so the fibers are generically finite. Restriction here is generically finite. And this geometric property translates into a height inequality, just using rather standard height properties and classical algebraic geometry. And what this translates into is fairly easy, that if I look at the height of an image of a point P under the morphism phi, I can bound this below by constant C1 of phi times the height of P minus some constant C2 of phi. And here C1, of course, is greater than 0. And this holds for all P in some open Zariski dense subset of X. Okay, so we got this inequality here. We can't expect really this to be all of X, because this morphism may have infinite fibers, and so you could travel along a fiber here on the right-hand side, and the left-hand side would be constant. And so what if happens now if we have that P is a zero of phi? Well, then, of course, the height will also be zero. And then we can, move everything to the left-hand side, and we get to the height of P is bounded by C2 of phi divided by C1 of phi. That looks like a good height bound, but the problem here is, of course, that everything defined depends on this phi here. And so we really have to get rid of this dependency on phi in order to get a height bound for P, which really just is uniform. So we need uniformity. In order to get uniformity, we somehow have to control these constants C1 and C2. And also the open set U. this is just a, this in lemma one, we can choose if you want equal to, this depends on phi, v of phi divided by the norm of phi to 2 times the dimension of x, some times some absolute constant phi, which depends only on the ambient abelian variety and choice of line bundles. And this phi is v of phi. This is a certain intersection number, and it's just the pullback of a line bundle on B, self-intersected B max times, times a cycle class associated to a variety X. So this is just as an intersection number, it's a non-negative integer. And so we're going to study this a bit more later on. But the proof here, this uses the criterion of few to show the existence of a non-zero global section of a certain line bundle. And this global section will then deliver a certain lower bound for heights, which more or less implies this inequality here. And a remark, well, we have C1 under control, but actually we need C1, C2, and U. But we're going to forget about C2 and U for the moment. We're just going to consider them as independent of phi for simplicity. But actually they have to be handled in a certain way, but it's not all too difficult, in fact. So how does this translate here into our inequality up here? So we can replace this now by, we have say C1, which is now independent of C numerator. We have 2 times the norm to the 2 dimension of X, and the denominator we have V of C. And so what we actually need to do is to bound this quantity from above, which is essentially equivalent to bounding this V of U here from below. So we need and this lower bound actually will be given conveniently by the next lemma. Lemma 2. And here enters again our compact set K. Lemma just says there exists a delta such that if this quotient here lies in K, then we can bound the norm at this V of C from below by delta times the norm to the 2 dim X. And of course, now this delta here, this depends just on the ambient of the abelian variety and all the other choices, but not on the phi or on the point P. And so this simplifies again here. Just, well, now I get 1 over C1 times delta instead of this term here. And it shows that this, of course, now is completely independent of phi and independent of the algebraic subgroup we're essentially looking at. And so this is the uniform bound we've been looking for. So the whole uniformity in this bound comes essentially from the uniformity here in this lemma, this lower bound here. And, well, we have a compact set K, and we have some kind of lower bound, so there's bound to be something continuous going on. And, well, look at this V here a bit more closely, as I defined over there. Forgot about for the moment. If we consider the association where we take a morphism between A and B to the pullback of our line bundle, takes a morphism to the Picard group of A. This is in general, if L is symmetric, then this is a quadratic form. And this follows from the theorem of the cube. And so if we plug that information there, the definition of phi, we got that this the association phi goes to, is still visible here. This here is a polynomial map. Of degree 2 times the dimension of x and homogeneous. So this is none other. So in particular, we can that being a polynomial means nothing other than if we choose a z basis of Hom AB, then we can just describe the value of z as a polynomial in the expansion coefficients with respect to the basis. And so, in particular, we can, just by extending scalars, we can extend z to a continuous map. Going from the homomorphisms of A, B tends to R now into the non-negative real numbers. If it is just by extending scalars, we know that this guy here is the V is a polynomial on the Z module, and then we can extend it to the R module. And now what we want to really look at is, remember, this quotient here. And because it's homogeneous, we can pull in the phi. We get this here, v of phi divided by the norm of phi. And if we assume that this here is contained in our compact set K, we see that this is bounded below uniformly by some positive delta, assuming that the v never vanishes on K. This is just a compactness argument. If we assume that this continuous map never vanishes on the set K, then it's bounded below by some uniform constant, which is positive, and that gives us just the inequality we need for the lemma. This implies lemma 2. So what's remained to be shown is that this V here never vanishes on K. That will imply the lemma and then the result. Well, this V here has a certain geometric meaning if this phi here is a homomorphism between abelian varieties, but what is the meaning of it when we insert a value which does not come from a homomorphism, which really comes from something with real coefficients? So what's the meaning of this vanishing here? So now if C is really an honest homomorphism, then if this here vanishes, then you can easily show using the projection formula that that the degree of C restricted to X vanishes. This is 0, then the projection formula implies that the degree of the restriction of phi to x is 0. And so in particular, this phi here will collapse the dimension of x. And that would be a contradiction to our XOA non-empty. because I said at the beginning of this hypothesis essentially will apply that XOA is empty. But what does it mean if X is C's now as something coming from the larger vector space? What if C is in HOM AB tends to R, and it vanishes, and V of C is zero? Well, we can always interpret the kernel of C as a tangent space as a vector space. And projecting this vector space down using the exponential function, we get an analytic subgroup. So the kernel G of C can be interpreted as an analytic subgroup of a set of complex points of A in this V group. We'll call this kernel G. And what this property V of C equals zero just means is that the intersection, now this essentially considered as complex analytic spaces with translates of this analytic subgroup is improper. For many points P. So this again meaning that the intersection here has dimension which is larger than what one would expect by just comparing dimensions. And many P means that for P coming from out of an open subset, open in the Hausdorff topology, subset of X. Okay, and so we're kind of in the situation where we have the intersection of our variety with certain analytic subgroups is improper, and this is showing this implication here involves certain geometry of numbers results and counting periods of abelian varieties. I'm not going to go into that part. I just want to mention right before the end that in order to salvage this situation, we have to apply a theorem of Axe dating back to 1972, which essentially says that if we're in this situation where we're intersecting our variety with analytic subgroups improperly, then we can more or less replace G by something algebraic. So that there exists an algebraic obstruction subgroup of A, so we'll call it G again, which also intersects X improperly. And this can be, again, translated using morphisms, which satisfies dim of phi of X strictly less than dim of X, where C is a morphism going from A to the quotient of A mod G. So this is now really, again, an abelian variety here because by Axe's theorem we can take G to be algebraic and inserting X into the C collapses its dimension. This already, again, implies that XOA is the empty set. So that would contradict our initial hypothesis. And so what this means in the end is that this can never vanish on K. So V of K is strictly positive, and then we get the lower bound, get the delta, and that completes the proof of the lemma 2 in sketch. And so I just want to say a few words on the toric situation. Well, I just went through the abelian case here. In the toric situation, you have some certain difficulties arise because the algebraic torus is not complete. For example, this function v of phi here, it's not so clear how you prove it, and it's not at all easy to show that it extends continuously in the same sense as in the Abelian case. But actually, you can go around this argument by a simple trick. And also, this theorem of acts here, this actually holds for all algebraic subgroups defined over complex numbers. There's no problem applying this acts theorem. And so the proof goes through rather similarly. Okay, thank you for your attention.